All right. Now, if you could please help me welcome our speaker for tonight, Kevin T. from the We Are Recovered group in Easton, Pennsylvania.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kevin Tarr. I am a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to say it's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to be here doing anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, this is kind of cool because this is really where it all got started for me. A couple years ago, March, I heard my sponsor tell his story down here. And in telling his story, he kind of told part of mine. I really related a lot with what he was saying. I identified with the internal condition, the pain. And that was probably a big thing for me because I felt like my whole life I never fit in. You know, being able to identify with somebody up here and realizing there was a little bit of hope. Let me start off by saying my sobriety date, February 25th of 2010. I do have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor guys and they sponsor guys. And for me, that puts me right in the middle of this dynamic of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been a journey. It's been a beautiful journey. I grew up, I like the big book tells me how to tell my story. I deal with all this little bit of fear before I get up here. You know, I get these feelings of fear and a lot of emotions and stuff going on. Pretty much all day I've been dealing with it. But for me, you know, I got up this morning and said a third step and a seventh step prayer, and that tells me that my feelings don't really get in the way of doing God's work. How I feel about it doesn't make a difference. And that's, I'm here. So the big book does tell me how I'm supposed to tell my story from in my own language, from my own point of view, how I established that relationship with God. You know, what it was like before I was plugged in. What happened for me to realize I had to get plugged into God, and what it's like today that I am plugged into God. And I will say, as a young kid growing up, I didn't realize I had this. I needed to be plugged into God, trust that. And it was, I grew up like 250 miles from here on the east coast of Virginia. And how I found my way here to Alcoholics Anonymous is in New Jersey in Alcoholics Anonymous is nothing short of a miracle. I called it coincidence when I got here. I know today it's the hand of a loving, caring God who relieved me of this bondage of self, this disease. So I grew up in a pretty normal home from what I've heard. You know, I hear a lot of stories on the podium, a lot of horror stories of there was no abuse in my home, anything like that. What my parents did was my parents were hardworking people, and they worked hard, they played hard. I was taught at an early age that it was okay to drink, party on the weekends, and party after work nights, just so you put in 40 hours a week, you know. Everything else was all good. And I will say this, I learned that from watching them. The same way when I got here, I learned from my sponsor. Like, he could tell me a lot of stuff, but I learned the most from watching him walk. Going out here, being active, carrying the message, working with alcoholics, taking them through the big book. So I learned that from my parents, that it was okay to do whatever I wanted to do as long as I put in 40 hours a week and didn't cause any trouble, didn't get locked up, everything would be fine. My dad was what the book describes as the problem hard drinker. You know what I mean? Something came up and he put it down. My dad's not drank probably going on 20 years now, and he does have a spiritual solution. He's real big into church, so I can't say, you know what I mean, if he's an alcoholic or hard problem drinker. But for me, I know when it came time to put it down, I'm that guy the book talks about, page 21. That's me. My problems don't go away when I put the drink down. My problems are just getting started. So I can't really relate with him just putting the drink down and walking away from it. That wasn't me. So anyway, I grew up, you know, when I look back at my childhood and really take a hard look, I have an older brother, and I kind of was like, he never got in any trouble in school. He always A's and B's on the report card or whatever. That wasn't me. I didn't do that. So I kind of felt like I was being measured by his standard. And sort of like I didn't measure up is kind of how I felt growing up. I had this feeling that I didn't fit in. But I surely, and I don't think anybody was judging me. You know, after doing fourth and fifth step work, I realized that that's not the case. But back then, that's how I felt. I really had had issues with, you're not doing as good as he is. Why don't you do better in school? He's doing better. And most especially not getting in trouble and running around. But my parents did give me everything I needed. Like I said, they were hardworking people. When I look back, I got everything I needed and most of what I wanted. The only thing wrong with my childhood is that it was my childhood. And in this alcoholic mind, it was never good enough. I always wanted to be somewhere else, always wanted to be somebody else, and I just couldn't get there. I definitely felt like I didn't fit in anywhere I went. So my mom and dad worked constantly. My dad had his own business, and my mom worked for the government, and my grandmother did a lot of raising me. And what I learned was my grandfather was alcoholic. That's one thing I do know. What I learned was my grandparents lived right next door to my house. So if things got tight at my house, I could always run next door. And then if my grandpa came home trashed, then I could run back home. And that was a trait I carried all the way up to 2 years ago when I got in New Jersey, 2.5 years ago. That's how I got here. I was running. So growing up, it was nothing out of the ordinary besides that feeling that I didn't fit in. You know, don't fit in, don't measure up. That's me. So I went through school, and along about maybe 14, 15 years old, first beer, you know the story. The first beer and first drink I ever had was not, it wasn't a bright light enlightenment thing or anything. I drank it and carried on. But I will say my first drunk, long about high school years, was that was very enlightening for me. I went from being the guy who never fit in to being the guy that, you know, you guys are lucky I'm here. That was it, you know. So for me, I found that, and when I found that, it was like I wanted to do it as much as often as I could. And we didn't drink every day or anything like that, but we did drink on every occasion we had the chance. Also, I grew up on an island. It's like 14 square miles, and maybe 5 miles of that is marshland, year-round population of about 3,000 people. So it was a beautiful place to grow up. But it was like everybody was in your business. Everybody knew what you were up to. You know, people down the street were looking out for you. And it was like everybody knew what was going on. So I grew up, also got introduced to surfing at a young age. And I realized for me that was one place that I really found that I could fit in and feel peace, man, was in the ocean. But the thing with that for me that I look back at it now is like I still didn't have any real connection with people when I was doing that. It's always by yourself, you know what I mean? And with that lifestyle goes partying. And the book says, our book says in the doctor's opinion, we can't safely use alcohol in any form at all. And for me, I'll get it over with now. There was a lot of forms of alcohol. It was pill form, powder form, bud form, rock form. It was all bets were off with me. But I was introduced to alcohol and drugs during that time, 15, 16 years old. And when I found it worked, when I figured out that it worked, I was good. I was at peace. So I went through high school, graduated high school, and that was it was like 40 people. I was asked somebody the other night how many people graduated in their class. It was like 40 people graduated in my class. So definitely living there was like everybody knew everybody. And it was all right until I got to that age where I was out running the streets and then the cops knew everybody. So I get out of school and start working for my dad in this business, contracting business. And I do learn a trade out of all this. I still do it today. But what I did when I got out of school was I went to work for him. And I worked for my pop, so I couldn't get fired. And I would surf any chance I got and party all the time. So I was selling a lot of these outside issues, we'll call them. And the cops knew everything that was going on the island. And I figured the best thing for me to do, I came to a point where I figured I would settle down. And the best thing for me to do probably would be, like, get married. So I took a hostage. And this, as you'll hear later, this is kind of a pattern of my behavior also. But I married this girl completely out of convenience, not out of love. And it got me off the street. It got the heat off, so to speak. And I kind of settled in, and everything looked good from the outside, you know. But inside, it was a wreck. I was drinking constantly. And somewhere in there, that line was crossed as to where, you know, I knew that the drink and the drink was the answer for me. I knew that that condition, that restless irritable, I didn't know it was restless irritable and discontent then. I do now. But I know that when I got home from work and all this noise got going in my head, I knew how to turn that off, and that was taking a drink. So that's what I proceeded to do. We got married in, I don't even know what year it was, but a couple years later, we had my first son. He's 16 today. And we had a son, and, you know, things were just constantly drink, you know, have kids. And 20 months later, it was like we had another son, and the drink was definitely like the main thing going on in my life. I wasn't worried about her or the kids or anything. It was all about that partying type deal. So what I'll say is that there came a point where she had had enough, and she said, "I'm going to leave." And I said, "Well, you'll have to go." And she went, and she took both kids with her. I went to work one day, came home, and not only did she take her and the kids, but she took all the furniture. It was like a TV left in the house. And what I did that night was I knew I could now do things as much as I wanted to, whenever I wanted to. Well, I proceeded to have a party that night at my house, you know, like 20 people, no furniture. And, you know, all bets were definitely off then. So it was just, I mean, it was okay back then. I look back at it now and I think how disgusting it was, and it must have been for her and my kids. But for me, it was okay because I knew when she was gone, the kids were gone. I knew they were safe with her mother, that I could just do what I wanted to do as much as I wanted to do it. So that continued for like 9 months. 9 months we were separated. And there came a point when I didn't really want her back as I did. I didn't like being away from my children. So I decided I'm going to quit drinking, quit doing all this other stuff, and I'm going to get my kids back. That's what I really wanted to do. So her uncle was a pastor at a church, and she had been visiting this church. Actually, she'd been going there pretty regularly. And I figured if I, you know, got in church, squared my life away, you know, that I could get my kids back in my life. And that's what I did. I proceeded to do that. I kind of joined the church. I got real active in the church and put the drink down for a while, for a period of about 3 years, I think, 3 years or and some change or whatever, I didn't pick up a drink. I did kind of like have a spiritual solution there, but more like it was, I was introduced to the God of my understanding there. So we got back together, and a couple years later, we had a third son. So now I have three kids, and I'm doing pretty good. I have my own business at this time. And life is really not bad. You know, like the storybook thing, we bought a house, had a couple cars, three kids, going to church, everything looks good on me. I'm actually active in the church, you know, working with the youth, doing some stuff. And I kind of had this thing with bodybuilding that I was into that for quite some time, so I get tangled up with some other outside issues on a real heavy-duty basis, and like my mind is twisted on this stuff, and the restless, irritable, and discontent is running wild, and my mind's talking to me. And I think it would be a good idea to walk away from the house, the kids, the cars. I kept my business, barely, but I thought it would be a good idea to walk away from all that, and this time I was walking away. I knew when I left this time that we were done. So that was a sober decision I made, to walk away from all that. I believe that's kind of why bottom this last time was a little bit hard to find, because I walked away from all that sober. So I walked away. We had bought a house on the mainland. I left all that, left everything. I had a backpack. That's what I had, full of clothes. My kids were young. I told my oldest son, you better, I remember distinctly what I told him when I left. Make sure you get some gloves so you can take some wood in for your mother, because I'm leaving. And I walked away. So I rent a little cottage, a little two-bedroom cottage on the island. And I proceeded to, for a period of time, I stayed sober. But I started going out, getting tangled up in the lifestyle, the bar lifestyle, you know, running around, acting like a heathen. And the most natural thing in the world happened. I picked up that drink. One New Year's Eve, a buddy of mine came over. He had two bottles of a wine, like some real cheap wine. And he's like, you want to get drunk? And I was like, yep. And that's what I did. I picked up right where I left off when I put it down a few years before. The progression of the disease, I can definitely report that. It took me about a week, and I was back up to where I was drinking. I got tangled up with some other outside issues. It was like, always for me, it was like alcohol get me to a certain point, and I'd want to sniff something that would get me here and then take something that would get me here. It really didn't matter to me. I just didn't want to be here. So that's what I did for a period of, I ran hard for a period of, probably 5 years. And, in this time of me being out there running, I moved house like twice. And the thing for me was this, was the hard part for me that when I look back, the hardest part for me was I'd be doing this for a period of time, and I would stop for a couple weeks, month. And my parents would get their hopes up. My kids would get their hopes up. I could never stay stopped. That was always my problem. When everybody got their hopes up, bam, I'd let them down. And for me, I think it would have been a whole lot easier just to stay out there doing what I was doing. So I moved house twice. My parents bought a house. In the meantime here, they bought a house for me to rent from them, which really I didn't rent from them. I just lived there and didn't pay. But my wife was having, my ex-wife at this time was having trouble with my oldest son. And she wanted to know if it was okay if he moved in with me. Now, I'm in the middle of this, being out there. And I mean, when I say out there, I mean way out there. And I had a girl living with me at the time. And I said, sure, let him move in. So my son, what I did was I went home, I told the girl, I go, you got to leave. My son's moving in. I kicked her out, and he moved in within a couple days. I proceeded to do the same thing I did when he moved in as I did before he got there. That didn't slow me up one bit. The only thing was, it was kind of like another hostage type situation. I knew he loved his dad. That's one thing I do know. But I knew he really didn't want to go back to be with his mother. And he really had some bad feelings in his heart for her. So what I did was I played on that, you know what I mean, and kept some bad feelings in his heart for her by some of the things I said and did, the actions I had. So he lived with me for about a year and a half. And the book says, what that book says in the doctor's opinion, it says the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. For me, the alcoholic, you know, living in his house with a son who's failed out of school because dad's too sick to take him, or he's too scared to go because he don't know what I'm going to do when he's gone. You know, that was normal to me. But what I had also done was I had made that alcoholic life normal for him. And that's to, you know, that speaks for itself. So I decided in February of 2009 that I really didn't decide this. Like, I had wrote some bad... My parents go to Mexico every year on vacation, and they go for like a month, you know, and in that month, it's like, I can only work a little bit, and I run out of money, and then I got to do other things to get money. So they had gone to Mexico on vacation, and I had wrote some bad checks. And actually, they weren't bad, but they weren't mine. So... I knew they were coming home at a certain time, and I knew that if they knew I was out there at that time, and I knew that if when they got home, I told them I wanted to check into rehab, that all this stuff would get swept under the carpet. And that's what I did. I checked into rehab February of 2009. And I went to rehab. Like, my son took me. My son and one of my friends took me. He's 14. Like 13 at this time, and he don't want to go stay with his mother, and he looks at me, and when we're on the way up there, you know, he did good all the way up, we're sitting, and I'm filling the paperwork out, and this, that, and the other, and he tears up a little bit and says, Dad, I told you to stop doing this, taking this, and I was like, it'll be all right, I'm only going to be here for a little while, things will be all right. And he did real good until the time when I had to go. He had to go to the front door, and I had to go to the back door. And then he lost it. He broke down. And the look of disgust that I seen in that kid's eyes was, for me, it was devastating. It was enough motivation for me to go through that rehab and kind of try to drive to do the right thing in order to get him back when I got out. Which that didn't really happen the way I had planned out in my head. But so I go to this rehab, and it's the rehab's in Maryland. It's a 12-step rehab. And I remember I'm saying a lot of stuff in that rehab. Like, I come out of there with a folder full of self-knowledge. And we know what self-knowledge gets us. But they did give me a big book. You know, I paid like $9,000 to be there for 21 days, and I got a big book. So it's the same big book I use today. What I will say, when I went in there, they would take us, you know, after detox, they would take you out like five nights a week to outside meetings. And they were pushing this other the other fellowship, the NA. And I will say one thing, that recovery up here is a lot different than down south from where I'm from. We haven't made, we truly haven't made up here. If you want to get better, there's people here that will take you through the work, and there's people here that are armed with the facts about themselves that know this book in and out and can get you to God. I didn't find that down there. But they were telling me a lot of stuff when I was getting ready to get out. You know, you're going to go to IOP, and you're going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You're going to get a sponsor and work the steps. And when I got out, you know, I had all this knowledge, this folder full of knowledge, and I had the thought of down the road someday I would get my kid back in my life. My oldest boy wanted to come back and live with me, so I was, you know, that was my thought. I proceeded to do nothing of what them people told me. I went to like 3 meetings, picked up a little key tag, said 30 days clean, bought an ounce of grass first week out, and you know, I did what I did. I will say this. I went back to the house that my mom and dad had bought, or I was trying to rent it from them. By then, I was paying a little bit, so it was more like renting. I went back to working 2 jobs, making killer money. I changed nothing about the person I am. And the one thing I figured when I got out of rehab was, if I would get home nights from work, and I'd get this, I know today it's restless, irritable, and discontent, mostly restless. But I could just not concentrate on anything. My mind was constantly racing. And I figured the way to fix this was to get into a relationship with a woman. You know, that would do it. So I get out of rehab, and I get online on this online stuff. And I meet this girl, and she's from New Jersey. And it's like she was far enough away where she would believe some of my mess. And so actually we started a relationship, and I'm living in Virginia with a house, and she's living up in Jersey with a house. And there becomes a little problem with the relationship early on. Like, I'm like maybe 60 days out of rehab, and I'm kind of leading her to believe I'm a little further along than I am. And there's some stuff going on in this relationship. And we kind of split up for a minute. And I figured, you know, by this time, it's working again. And I know one thing that'll turn that noise off in my head. And that's a handful of what I was doing before I went in there. And I went and picked up again. Now, this is $9,000 later at rehab. I was without defense against the first drink. I will say that. So what I do is I continue to use drink the way I was drinking. But the thing is, she doesn't really know it because we're only seeing each other every other weekend. It's like she'll come down to the island, and then the next weekend I'll come up here. So I can hide it pretty good. I keep everything under wraps pretty good. And I meet her mom, you know what I mean, and her parents. And she meets mine, and she has kids, and I have kids, and it's just everything's good except for this little thing that I you know, I'm drinking again. And she doesn't know it. So somewhere in the middle there, we decided we'd get married. So I married this girl. And at this time that I marry her, I am out there. I remember going on the honeymoon, getting sick, you know, everything. And she's still clueless that that I've picked up again. And at the time we get married, we're still living in separate houses. She's up here and I'm down there. Well, I would say that was, we got married in November, December, January, a couple months. We went on back and forth, back and forth. In that time, I let her know that I was drinking again. And in that period of time, like before Christmas, I came up here and I was going to detox at her house. And I stayed up here for about 4 days. I'm like, yeah, I'm good. And I head back home. And before I get across the bridge there in Easton, I'm on the phone. And I know what'll fix how I feel. And so I didn't even go home. I went right to where I could get what would fix how I was feeling. And that kind of was like the ending of the deal for me. I made it through Christmas. I do remember that. Made it through Christmas, traveling back and forth with her, and down home with my kids. And January, I had like a couple credit cards. Well, so I straight up stole some credit cards and used them to order some stuff. It wasn't even like I had a business credit card from my dad, but it wasn't even just that one. So now I got these credit cards that are maxed out that don't belong to me. And I got some people down south that I owe a couple dollars too, and I pack that steam backpack full of clothes, and I come up here. This is my last stop. You know, I knew I couldn't stay there, and I knew she really didn't know what was going on, so it would be safe up here. So that's what I did. I moved up here. Everything was wonderful for about a day. She happened to call home and talk to my mother about what was going on because my kids had called, and they were very upset that I had left. They weren't speaking to me because I had ran off on them. And she called my mom to find out what was going on, and my mom told her. And she told me February 24th, 2010. She said, and I try not to curse when I'm up here, but she told me to get the F out and take my dog with me. So the only problem with that is that I got like $8 in my pocket. I have no place to go. I've lived on this island, this little teeny island in Virginia my whole life. I'm up here in a strange land in New Jersey. And the worst part about it is I got nobody to call. I can't call anybody and get anybody to send any money down up here to me. I was done, dude. I was at that place, that alone place. So what I did was she told me to leave, and then I said I'll leave tomorrow. Because it was, I don't like driving at night and some stuff, you know, something I peddled her. And she bought it, and she left the house that night, went to her mother's house, and I prayed that night. God helped me figure out something. And what he helped me figure out, that was like what happened. What he helped me figure out was that she came back the next day, and she was like, I really don't want you to leave, or I really want you to try to get help. That night that she left and went to her mother's house, two people from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous came to the house and gave me the 12-step spiel. And I really didn't know it was 12-step spiel when they got there. They were just like, it was actually her mom's boyfriend and one of his friends. Her mom's boyfriend had been sober like 15 years. Her mom had been in the program when I got here about 24 years. And the other guy was, you know, 20-something years sober. And they came over and they told me their story. And I really could identify with the one guy a little bit. It wasn't like I wanted what he had, but I could just identify. He gave me just a little bit of hope is what he gave me. And so she comes back the next day and says, I really don't want you to leave. I really want you to try to get help. And I had prayed the night before, and I didn't have any place else to go. I said, all right, I'll try to get some help. So I called these guys up. I said, is there any way you can try to get me in a detox? And they said, we'll be at your house at 5 o'clock. And they proceeded to get there at 5 o'clock. They drove me all around the state of New Jersey. I actually tried to get me in one over here. I have a Virginia driver's license and no health insurance, so nobody's taking me. But what that did was that they were reaching that hand of AA out, and it kind of gave me a good introduction to what you people were all about, man. They went out of their way for a drunk and a dope fiend like me to try to help me out. So needless to say, I didn't get into a detox. I started the detox process at home, which I don't recommend. But what they did was, at that time, there was a guy in their home group who had been 9 years, 11 months sober, and he had gone back out, and he was just coming out of rehab at that time, the same time I got here. And they introduced me to him, and we started powering up and going to meetings together. And really, I had no idea about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew the 12 steps on the wall. I knew them from that rehab I was in. But that's about all I knew. So I can say, this, for me, this program works 100%, 100% success rate. But that's all I knew really was about it was just 12 steps, go to meetings. I thought, you know, you go to meetings. I thought meetings were a cure for alcoholism. I've come to find out that's not the case. So They introduced me to this guy at a meeting at their home group up in Bloomsbury, New Jersey. And he had a little bit of peace about him. When I talked to him, he was just like, when your head clears up, give me a call. And I seen him at a couple other meetings. And I wanted to feel like he looked. That's all. He definitely had that light. The light was on. And then we all came down here, sitting in this room. And he told his story. And like I said earlier, I really identified with that internal suffering part. You know what I mean? And the very next day or the day after, I went home and I asked him to be my sponsor. And I had no... My mother-in-law, 20-something years sober, she tells me, find somebody you can relate with and ask them to be your sponsor. Dude, I'm 4 days sober. The only person I can relate with is another person 4 days sober. I don't need a sponsor I can relate to today. I need a sponsor I'll take direction from. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he didn't give me that, you know, don't drink, go to meetings. He didn't say none of that stuff, put the plug in the jug, none of that mess. What he told me was, we're going to get together every weekend, and we're going to do some work out of this big book. He said, do you have a big book? I said, yep, paid $8,000 for it. So I got a hold of that book, and we sat down and we walked. He coached me through these 12 steps. And when I'm sharing like this, I really like to walk through these steps as I perceive them, as I was taught them, and as I hand them out to my guys today. That first step for me was the powerless part was pretty obvious. My sponsor's big on acting powerless. You know, we act powerless. We show up at meetings. if somebody needs help, we go out and help out. It was life and death for me when I came in here. Today, it's still life and death for me. You know what I mean? My recovery is, dude, it comes before everything. Anybody who knows me on a personal level knows that I go to any length on a daily basis. I am powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. When I got here, those two thoughts were directly connected. I was powerless over alcohol, therefore my life was unmanageable. Today, those two thoughts are not connected, but they're still very true. My life is unmanageable by me. 2 years and some change later, my life is still as unmanageable as it was by me the day I walked in this door. I have to have a power greater than myself to run this show for me. Unmanageability. I got a lot of stuff that hangs on my recovery today. I have my own business. I have my relationship with my kids. I just bought a house, cars, whatever. Dude, all that stuff hangs from my recovery. Without it, all that falls to the floor and shatters. My life is unmanageable by me 2 years later, just as unmanageable. And then it says, we got to that, we agnostics, that chapter, we agnostics, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I told you I had this little bit of church in my background. Just enough church in my background that I have a little prejudice against this sponsor going to tell me anything about God. That's how much church I have in my background. So he said, go read this chapter, and then we're going to get together next week, and we're going to talk about it. And he sat me down, and he asked me the word I seen most in that chapter. And he knew. The word I seen most in there was God. The word he pointed out to me was prejudice. And for me, that I work with a lot of guys today, take them through the 12 steps. I point that same word out. Prejudice is not always good, not always bad prejudice. It can be good prejudice. It says in that book, as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe, as soon as we commenced to get results. And as soon as I was able to lay that prejudice aside, I commenced to get results. He made that real clear to me, and that was a big one for me. And this third step, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to care of God as we understood Him. I thought I had done that when I was in those church years. I really did. You know, getting on my knees in the morning and praying to a God I had no understanding. I thought I understood Him, but a God I didn't know, I couldn't get in contact with. I really thought I had done that back then, but why did all this stuff happen in the meantime? And my sponsor says, will and lives are thoughts and actions. Turn my thoughts and actions over to care of God. And I really, that third step prayer in our book, I like to break that down with my guys. I offer myself today to do with me as you will. What do I offer to God on a daily basis? And what does that mean to me today? When I say that prayer, I think, what does that mean to me today? What am I offering to God? I'm offering my relationship with my kids, my house, my business. You know, take it all. That's what I give God on a daily basis. Take it all. My life's unmanageable. I have to have Him to run the show. And then offer myself today to do with me as well, build with me as well. And then it says, somebody help me with that prayer. How's the next line go? The bondage of self. For me, this alcoholic mind, you know, it tells us in the book, the disease centers in my mind. So with this alcoholic mind, I can't wish that away, the bondage of self. You know what I mean? I know for me, alcohol always relieved me the bondage of self, always. It worked every time. So now I have to have something. When I take that alcohol out of there, I have to have something that's going to do the same. It's going to relieve me that bondage of self. And that has to be a power greater than myself. And then that other, the next line of it says, take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, thy love, thy power, and thy way of life. Why is God going to relieve my difficulties? So I can have a good time in life? I don't think so. It's so, for me, it's so anybody who's having a hard time in life can see what God can do through me. I'm the guy that was sitting down here in this chair so fearful when they're reading the 12 steps. I want to go out that door. You know, God says, not tonight, man. He says, get up behind that podium. Show them what I can do. I take no credit for anything I've done since I got here, man. It's all of God in these 12 steps. In that fourth and fifth step, a fearless moral inventory, I can't say I wasn't real keen on doing it. You know what I mean? I never thought I'd be sitting down with another guy telling him all this stuff. I wasn't scared of doing it. I was scared not to do it. I knew. My sponsor just wanted me to trust him long enough till I could trust God. So I could get this mess cleared away and get in contact with that power greater than myself. So I made the list. I did the work, and we sat down. Four and five, for me, really contained the forgiveness process. That's what I found out of it. List, prayers, and observations. The list, writing the list didn't do much for me, but the observations and the prayers sure did. It's where I found forgiveness for a lot of people who I thought had done a lot of things to me. And then six and seven. I think six in our books is we emphasize a willingness to be indispensable. Indispensable. I looked that up. Every time I take somebody through the work, I forget what it means. So I look it up, and the definition is absolutely necessary. And if I'm to be absolutely necessary to God, then I have to get rid of a lot of this stuff. You know, I'm sitting down here asking God to remove my fear on a daily basis. Three and seven, I do on a daily basis. And that really makes how I feel none of my business. Absolutely. I can't let my feelings, my emotions dictate what I do in life and how I act in life. I've learned that I do a lot of things in this program that I have feelings about. The big thing for me is I don't let those feelings get in the way. You know, I can have the feelings all I want to, but in order for me to be doing God's work, I can't let them get in the way. And then eight and nine. Made a list of all persons to be harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And then made direct amends to such people wherever possible. For me, when I did four and five on my fear list, I had a fear of making amends because I knew that was coming. Some of the stuff I had done, and I knew I had absolutely stolen a lot of money from my parents, the people who loved me most. and I wasn't, you know. Number one thing is I was up here without a job, living off my wife's unemployment, and she has three kids of her own, so how am I ever going to pay this back? How am I ever going to do it? I know for me, when I became willing, when God put somebody on my mind, I immediately went to him and made that amends to the best of my ability. I would go to Virginia, and I owed my dad and mom a lot of money. I would go to Virginia, and they would never take money from me. Never. They knew I was struggling financially. So what I would do is I would go down there, drop $20 in their mailbox every time I was there, and I would call them when I was leaving the island and say, I left some of that money I stole from you in the mailbox. And that's what I did. I came into some money a couple years ago, and I was able to make those amends to the tune of about 20-something thousand bucks between them and my ex-wife, little back child support. But what that did was that really freed me up. You know, I get to walk the earth a free man today. There's nobody gaining on me. Nobody. I don't have to look over my shoulder. I'll hit back on that one in a second because I got a lot going on in my life right in a second. 10, continue to take personal inventory. 10 and 11 for me kind of go together. Like if I'm not doing 10, then I really can't get in contact with God in 11. I know for me that personal inventory on a daily basis is one of the most important things I do. Looking for selfishness, dishonesty, and that's that every hour of every day I have to be doing that. And then prayer and meditation. For me, when I get up early in the morning, like before work, I know I got to kind of turn it up a notch. I know what my day consists of. The first 8 or 9 hours of my day, I'm going to go to work. I'm going to treat the customer like a person, not a paycheck. I'm going to do my job to the best of my ability. So my prayer in the morning sometimes is real quick. God, thanks for giving me another day. Now I give it back to you. When I get home from work and my body's a little tired, that's when I can really get to God, pray and meditate, because I know when I leave the house the second time to go out and go to meetings and go look for new guys to take through this work and to show them a little hope, I know that's when I really got to be connected. So that's when I get with God. And then the biggest promise that I find in this book, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message and practice these principles in all our affairs. For me, I had the spiritual awakening 2 years ago. That will not keep me sober today. I do know that. I do, to the best of my ability, try to have a new spiritual experience every day. I get with God on a daily basis. I try to carry this message to somebody else, look for a newcomer, somebody I can help. Today, life is quite a bit different than when I got here. I've been able to do some real cool stuff in sobriety. I grew up on the Eastern Shore of Virginia down there. I've been able, within the past maybe 6 months, I've hooked up with some people down there in the program, and we've been able to take speakers from up there, down there, and kind of give back to a place that I took my whole life. I took from down there, robbed that place of anything. So we've been able to go back and carry the message down there, give back to a place that I love and care for. My kids are back in my life. We have a pretty good relationship today. You know, I can be present when I'm with them. I don't get to see them as much as possible. I gave that away. I gave the opportunity away to be with my kids on a daily basis every day, see them every day. But when I do see them, I'm present. I'm there. You know what I mean? And when I like, 8 and 9 is kind of tough for me lately because that girl that I married is kind of like, we're in the middle of separation and kind of divorce type thing. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know what God's will is down the road. But I do know that, like, that amends had to be made. I had to go to her. It was coming up in my 10th step every night, the dishonest part that I really couldn't give her what she was trying to give me. If I was her, I would have divorced me a year ago, honestly. I'm out ripping and running, doing the best I can do in this program to do God's work. And I just feel like I rob her of a lot of happiness. And it's okay until I see it, until I see how unhappy she is. So within the past couple weeks, I went to her and made that amends and got real brutally honest with her. I will say this, that it's been, the past couple weeks has been kind of tough. Spiritually, I've stayed connected. The big thing with me is that spiritually I got free. I came down off the cross that day when I went and talked to her about that. So I will say there's a lot of work still to be done for me personally, but this journey has definitely been, the past 2 years, I went from the guy who never measured up, never fit in, couldn't look at myself in the mirror. When I look in the mirror today, there's no person in the world I'd rather be than me. And for this alcoholic, that's vital. I want to thank all these guys that came down with me. It's a whole, like, 3 carloads of us. And I absolutely want to thank the group for having me down here. And I want to thank AA for my life. Thank you, guys.